Well, go ahead and grab your Bibles if you have them and turn with me to Ecclesiastes. That's the book of Ecclesiastes, and we'll be picking it up this morning in chapter 3. Well, it's been quite some time since we've been in the book of Ecclesiastes, and so sort of my dilemma this morning is that we've come to a point in the book where it's getting a bit harder for me to offer sort of a full review of where we've been so far. And so I think what I'll just say kind of by way of reminder is that Solomon, or more formally Kohelet, that is the teacher or preacher, the one speaking these things, has been making a series of observations about life. And so if you remember, he's observed that this life which you and I live is not only short and fleeting, but also actually twisted. He's seen that there's this twistedness and really even this upside downness that characterizes all of life. And so what's been interesting and what we've discovered is that you don't have to be a Christian or really even understand the Bible to know this. It's simply part of your human experience. And so no matter who you are or where you're from, you're intimately acquainted with this reality. And so what we've seen in the book of Ecclesiastes is that at some level or another, we all wrestle with the reality of trying to find ultimate purpose, ultimate meaning, and ultimate significance. And so no matter who you are or really even what you have, the reality is that you're in the consistent state of still trying to attain more joy, more happiness, and more satisfaction. But the problem that Solomon's observed so far in Ecclesiastes is that no matter what your worldview, no matter what your socioeconomic status, no matter what you are able to attain or really what you have, everything always seems to fail. So like despite all the effort and all the attempts at trying to attain full satisfaction or full lasting contentment, no matter what you pursue, no matter what you grab onto, nothing ever seems to satisfy. Your job doesn't provide it for you. Your family or that relationship doesn't provide it for you. All the pleasure and leisure you seek never delivers as promised. And so we spend a lifetime chasing after things that we think will deliver. And Solomon has showed us that the reason we do that is because according to chapter 2, you and I possess a heart that's had eternity placed on it. And so we're constantly trying to fill the eternal void, but the problem is that everything in this world is finite. And yet we bought into the lie that something will actually satisfy, that something's got to be out there that will fill the eternal void and give ultimate happiness. But the conclusion of Solomon, which he's said sort of on repeat, is that all attempts are simply an exercise of futility. Because despite all the advancements in knowledge and technology, the reality is that there is nothing new under the sun. At best, we get distracted for a season because things might come in new packages or new colors, but we're soon disappointed because as he says in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 1, what has always been is what will always be. And so Solomon simply observes that the human experience is like chasing after the wind. Where even if he knew where it was coming from or where it was going, he wonders, what would you catch it with? But beyond these things, there also seems to be a brokenness. A brokenness in the family, a brokenness in the workplace, a brokenness in this world, even a brokenness in your own heart. You don't have to go very long or search your memory very hard to discover that you had or perhaps even right now have thoughts, dreams, and desires that are twisted. Maybe you delight in something or even see yourself being drawn to something right now that if brought to the public eye would be shameful. And so what we've learned is that biblically, that is what the scriptures teach, is that this predicament that you and I find ourselves in is actually due to God's curse on this world, which he gave out back in Genesis chapter 3. And so as a result of that curse, all of creation, according to Paul in Romans chapter 8, has been groaning under the weight of this curse and is longing to be redeemed. And so even if you don't buy into this narrative that the scriptures teach, you can't deny the fact that there's something wrong with this world. That there's something, perhaps even something deep inside of your own soul, that's longing for this world to be set right. You recognize there's something broken and twisted, maybe even in your own life, that so desperately needs to be fixed. There's something missing, something fractured. But you can't seem to find the answer. And so this world, indeed perhaps your own life, remains broken. So this entire creation, which includes you and me, has been completely defined in every aspect by this curse, which Solomon, our author here, has labeled with the Hebrew word havel. And so there's this twistedness, this brokenness, this havel to life. And so what we've seen Solomon do over the course of a couple chapters here is just sort of look out at life and really the various spheres of life that every human walks in, and he's observed that this twistedness or this havel defines all of it. And so we've seen the havel of monotony, the havel of pleasure, the havel of wisdom, the havel of labor. And so what we'll see today is that this reality of havel exists in yet one more sphere of life, and that's the havel of injustice and depression. So let's go ahead and read here, starting in verse 16 of chapter 3. And we'll make our way, Lord willing, this morning through verse 3 of chapter 4. So beginning here in verse 16 of chapter 3, Solomon writes, "Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. So I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for time for every matter and for every deed is there. I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is havel. All go to the same place, all came from the dust, and all return to the dust. And who knows that the breath of man ascends upward, and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which are being done under the sun, and behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they too had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun." Such a happy guy. All right, well, we saw last time that we are indeed creatures living in the Creator's world, and that this Creator is far more in control of His creation than we oftentimes like to acknowledge. Solomon showed us that God has sovereignly appointed all things, and that there is nothing in your life or in this world that happens apart from His sovereign determination, choice, and rule. And so now, coming off of that truth, Solomon wants to address an issue. And he's got a specific agenda in mind. And really what's driving this agenda is a question. So he's just acknowledged in the beginning of chapter 3 that God is sovereign over every aspect and every detail of life. And so if that's the case, if God has providentially determined every thought, deed, and reality, Solomon, being a king and standing in the place of judgment and justice, wants to know why God has ordained for the reality of injustice and oppression to exist. Like, if God is sovereign and does indeed possess the power to control all things after the counsel of His will and His good pleasure, why does a good, righteous God allow wickedness and unrighteousness to remain? That's His question, and that's what we'll see Him address this morning. So let's go ahead and jump into this section here, starting in verse 16. He writes, "Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness." Now, he begins here by just making the observation. And those two little phrases there, the place of justice and the place of righteousness, are really just phrases in reference to the same thing. They're actually statements or phrases speaking of that official place or capacity where justice and righteousness should reign. And so while the observation of Solomon expands and really does apply to the broader reality of injustice and unrighteousness in the world, whether it be in the family, in marriages, or in the church, the specific reference he has in mind here, due to those phrases, is actually the God-ordained institution where the justice of God and the righteousness of God should be upheld. In other words, it's simply a reference to the official courtrooms of government. And time doesn't really allow us to do this, but let me just say that government, and specifically the judicial aspect of government, is something God has established and something God has ordained. And He's designed it in the first place to be a vehicle through which He might put on display His character and His attribute of righteousness. And so while people try to use government for all sorts of things, and while government, at least in our country, has so much overstepped that God-ordained purpose, it is important to know that the actual and really the original point of government and God's official design and purpose of government, according to Romans 13, is simply to protect the innocent and to punish evildoers. In other words, its primary purpose and function is judicial. And so all that Solomon is saying here is that if there's one place in the world where the justice of God should be met and the righteousness of God put on display, it's in the courtrooms. This is before the church existed. And so Solomon, being the observer that he is, takes a step back from life and he sees a problem. He sees that in the very place where justice and righteousness should reign, he says, "I see wickedness." And that's the twisted thing. That's the havel. And is this not true? Is it not true, even in our land, that in the place where there should be safety, protection, justice, and purity of judgment, where the attributes of God's justice and righteousness ought to shine forth, there is much injustice and much unrighteousness? For example, and these are obviously a couple bigger ones, but for example, on January 22nd, 1972, in a 72 majority vote, the United States Supreme Court ruled in favor of a woman's right to kill her unborn child. Why is it that in the very place where the innocent and those without a voice ought to find protection, there is instead a sanctuary for where murderers find protection? It's backwards. Or, more recently, on June 26, 2015, in a 5-4 majority vote, the United States Supreme Court guaranteed same-sex couples a fundamental right to the God-ordained institution of marriage. Why is it that in the very place where the righteous design and decree of God should be honored and upheld, it's distorted, tainted, and redefined so as to suit the unrighteous desires of sinful people. It's backwards. There is simply a twistedness and brokenness, or to use the language of Solomon, wickedness in the very place from where righteousness and justice should flow. And I know I've sort of used examples that are closer to the so-called Judeo-Christian ethic, but you don't have to be a Bible-believing Christian to know that this reality exists. And every single person in this room has what theologians call a judicial sentiment. That is, as one man states, you have an innate moral desire because you've been created in the image of God that longs to see justice prevail, wrongs righted, and evildoers punished. You have, without compromise, an irrepressible response, a moral outrage, and an indignation when someone commits an injustice against you. And it's impossible for you not to feel this. And Romans chapter 2 states that this reality is proven by the very fact that you don't need someone to teach you that murder is wrong. You don't need to be taught that when someone breaks into your home and takes something from you, it's wicked. You don't need to be taught that cosmic standards exist which govern what is right and determine what is wrong. It's simply built into this universe, and so every created person is guided and controlled by these universal standards. On your heart, God has stamped his law. And there's not a person in this world for whom this is not true. And so my point in all of this is simply to say that this is why a completely ungodly person, that is one who gives not one thought to God or his law, can look out into the courtrooms or the world in general and know that in the depths of their own soul, that wickedness is an ever-present reality in the very place where there should be justice. And so Solomon looks out into the world, and he sees this. And so now, making the observation, he very quickly comes to some responses. And these responses are marked out by these two I said statements in verses 17 and 18. So let's take a look. Response number one on the problem of injustice, verse 17. He states, "And I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for time for every matter and for every deed is there." So Solomon makes the observation and really even accepts this reality that something's backwards, that there's this wickedness in the place of justice. And he's immediately consoled with the conclusion that no matter what the outcome, no matter how much injustice or wickedness might prevail, in the end, in the final analysis, there's this day coming where every thought, matter, and deed will be brought to account. And this statement here of judging not only the wicked, but also the righteous, is simply Solomon's way of stating that there's not one person in the history of man who will escape this judgment. And notice what he says here. He states in the NASB, it's worded a little bit differently depending on your translation, but he says, "For a time for every matter and for every deed is there." And what he's actually doing here with that final pronoun there, it's a little fumbly, but what he's doing is pointing to the eschaton, that is to the end times, to the final judgment to come. And so if you think about it, what he's actually doing here is he's actually giving us a reason for why we ought not to be shocked that injustice still remains. Because coming off this section on there being a time for every event under the sun, the point Solomon's making is that God hasn't forgotten. He isn't just sweeping the wickedness under the rug, but rather he in his infinite wisdom, before the ages began, appointed a time to right all the wrongs of the world. And so what Solomon's implying here is, don't be shocked. Don't be a people who are surprised at the ever-present reality of unrighteousness. God sees it, he knows it, and he's appointed a time to judge it. And so really, the implication of this text is for you to ask yourself that if that's the case, that if God is ultimately going to right every wrong, where then is your hope? Where are you finding rest? I think this will become quite evident over the next few months, if it hasn't already. If you're the kind of person who's constantly looking to the next elections for ultimate solutions and answers, in other words, hope, Solomon's point is the only guarantee you'll ever have is despair. But the truth of this passage is that if you have your eyes set on the judgment to come, where the one who judges in perfect justice will bring every deed and every thought to account. Can you imagine? The application of Solomon is you have every cause for hope and every cause to live out your days in rest. Solomon's theme. For as Doug Wilson comments on this passage, this verse promising judgment is very important. This gift, and I think that's an important word because I don't think we think about it that way. This gift of the knowledge of God's judgment and ultimate justice puts every judicial monstrosity in perspective. In a day when judicial monstrosities grow like thistles in sunshine, this is a timely encouragement. So the wisdom of Solomon here is actually very simple. If you want to be a person who can live joyfully and restfully in the midst of injustice, all you have to do, or rather be, is a forward-looking person. Or as Paul would say in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, be a person looking to that which is unseen. And so while that might not be satisfying counsel for some, it is biblical. And it's what Solomon, and therefore God, gives us to rest in. Now, having said that, while Solomon does respond somewhat hopeful here because of the judgment to come, he's still left with the question of why. Why is it that if God is all-powerful, being completely sovereign over every detail and every event of life, as he stated in the beginning of chapter 3, does he still allow injustice to remain? Which is actually a really fair question, and perhaps one that you might have posed to you from time to time. Like so much pain and so much suffering could have been avoided had God just stepped in and done something about it. So what is God's purpose in allowing wickedness to remain? Well, he answers it here with his second response, starting in verse 18, which actually goes all the way through verse 21. He states, so I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. If you've ever wondered why God has allowed wickedness to remain, Solomon's simple answer is that God is doing this so that he might allow us to see ourselves for what we really are. And he compares us to the beasts. One man puts it this way. He states the rampant injustice among human beings ends up being a clear manifestation, indeed a divine revelation, that human beings are nothing but animals. And don't misinterpret this. Solomon here is not arguing for a sort of scientific or evolutionary explanation of human behavior, but is simply trying to expose that man in his sinful practice of injustice shows himself to be more like beasts of the field than creatures who bear the image of their creator. In other words, his point is that God is simply showing to us the absolute absurdity of our sinful ways. Which, by the way, is why humanism, the philosophy that humans, not God, are of prime importance, and therefore, when left to ourselves, are actually capable of great achievements like love and virtue, pretty much the theme of every modern movie, gets it so wrong. We can't even get the basic virtue of justice right. Look at the world, read history. It's filled with injustice. Now, this isn't the only place in the Bible where this language of beast appears to describe man in his unbelief. For instance, in Psalm 49, you don't have to turn there, but the writer, rebuking the rich and the arrogant, states in verse 12, "But man in his pomp will not endure, for he is like the beasts that perish." And then going on to observe how arrogance actually blinds the rich, he repeats the refrain in verse 20, stating, "Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish." And so what's interesting about these passages is that in both cases, the language of beast is used to describe a person who's exploiting the weak for the sake of personal gain. In other words, injustice. And which in both passages is the essence of a fool. And the reason they're described as fools is because the Bible identifies a fool as one who lives life without reference to the inevitability of death, and therefore death's necessary implication, which is judgment. Which, by the way, is why Psalm 14 can say the fool has said in his heart, or literally has convinced himself in his own mind, that there is no God. The very definition of a fool is always one who lives life and makes decisions without reference to the ever-present reality of God's ensuing judgment. And so the point is that you might be able to convince yourself that there is no God, and therefore freeing you to say what you need to say and do what you need to do and exploit whom you need to exploit for the sake of personal gain. But when you do that, Solomon's point is to say you're doing nothing more than showing yourself to be like an ignorant beast. And so he says in verse 19, if you want to act like a beast, at least go and observe the beast, because just as it dies, so shall you. In other words, don't ever forget the fact that you're nothing more than a finite creature. I think being human and seemingly possessing freedom, where we're so good at exercising our own self-will and expressing individual autonomy, has this way of self-deluding us to the reality that we are but dust. And so lest we forget, Solomon's faithful to remind us of that in verse 20, picking up on Genesis 3:19, "From dust you came, and so to dust you shall return." And so lest you somehow assume that death will be your means of escape from any kind of judgment over your wickedness and living your life without reference to the Creator. Look at what he says here in verse 21. He writes, "And who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth?" And so while some have taken this statement to think that Solomon is rather agnostic on the afterlife, that is, he just doesn't really know what happens, in the context here, it's actually best understood as a rhetorical statement. And so all he's doing here with this question is really just providing a commentary on how very few people, especially the unjust and the wicked, do what they do precisely because they never actually stop to consider what happens in death. In other words, they don't live their life with reference to judgment. And so he says, look, you want to live like a beast? You want to act like an ignorant animal? That's fine. But while they just cease to exist when they die, you, on the other hand, have a soul and a kind of breath that will ascend upward to the Creator and Judge. And so what Solomon's doing here by picking up on Genesis 3 in verse 19 is he's actually trying to invoke in his readers' minds who would have been very familiar with Genesis, the whole context of the creation account, where there man is very clearly created uniquely and distinctly from the animals. He's created with the image of God, bearing an eternal soul, and which therefore necessitates that he's held accountable to the Creator. So while we might think God is perhaps cruel in allowing injustice to remain, God is simply turning around here and reminding us, look, the cruelty of injustice is the result of broken, sinful human beings. It's you. And so the truth of this text is that God, in allowing us to live, is simply testing us. That is, he's granting to us life so that he might prove us to be what we really are, which is wicked. And so Solomon's point here is simply to say that when judgment comes, God will be proven to be incredibly just in his judgments, and the reason for that is because there'll be a history of evidence against you. So if you want to be a wise person, which is what Solomon's trying to make us, don't forget that, you'll be the kind of person who lives your days with reference to what's to come. And so as bleak as this message might be, the consistent message of Solomon is that you are going to die. The death rate is 100%. Everyone always dies, and as such, you will face your Creator in judgment. And it's there, as he says in chapter 12, that there is nothing that will go unseen. All will be brought to light. You will give an account for every thought, matter, word, and deed, whether it be good or evil. And on that day, the only thing that will be shown is not only that God has been incredibly patient with you, but also, and more importantly, that God, unlike the corrupt courts of this world, will be shown to be absolutely just and righteous in his judgments. And it's the fool who denies this reality. The truth of the Bible is that every man, woman, and child in the history of this world bears in them the image of their Creator. Each has a soul and each has eternity placed on it. All of us. Whether we choose to accept this truth or not, live day by day and moment by moment under the scrutiny of the all-seeing, all-knowing judge. And that's the point of verse 21. It's not an agnostic question, especially because of that little phrase there in the light of verse 17 about how the breath of man does indeed ascend upward, but furthermore, it's a reflection on the reality that too few people live with an ever-present awareness of what's to come. And so let me just add this comment here, because I think it's implied in the text. While there are people who live their lives ignoring this truth, the implication of this verse is that a day is coming where they will no longer be able to ignore this truth. How many people, and I'll even include Christians on this one, how many people live their days, go about their decisions, think certain thoughts, perform certain actions, or feel they have the freedom to say certain things simply because there is very little immediate consequence? Social media has trained us in this. The wisdom of Solomon is, do not be such a fool. There is no thought, decision, or action that has no ultimate consequence. If there's one thing that people ought to have in the forefront of their minds, it's that the judgments of God are not only perfect, full, and everlasting, but also inevitable. Ignoring God, or simply choosing not to believe in his existence or judgment, actually has zero bearing on the inevitable reality of his judgments. And so the call of Solomon on your life is, do not ignore this truth. Every thought, deed, and matter bears with it the weight of eternity. So what's Solomon's conclusion? What's his final word and solution regarding the Havel of injustice? Verse 22. He writes, I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Now, I find this to be a really interesting conclusion, because it doesn't really seem to follow what he's just said, does it? Like, what does this have to do with the problem and issue of injustice? Well, to be honest, it's not really a conclusion that ought to shock us. And the reason for that, if you remember, is because it's actually the same exact conclusion that he's given to every form of Havel that we've seen so far. And so his answer here to the problem of injustice and wickedness is simply to enjoy life. Look at what he says. He states, there is nothing better than that man should be happy in his activities. And you could take those activities to be the same things he's mentioned in chapter 2, verse 24, and chapter 3, verse 13, which are those basic duties and gifts of life, namely eating, drinking, and labor. And notice why he says this. He gives a reason. He states, for that is his lot. So this is a little hard to follow, but essentially what he's saying is this. Here's sort of the argument. He's saying the reason for why so many people are unable to find joy in the midst of wickedness is simply because they're so busy trying to solve a problem that God has ordained to remain. In other words, they're trying to solve a problem that is not for them to solve. And so while that might sound a bit strange, if you're following the argument, the point of Solomon here is simply to say that the duty of man is not found in trying to fix the Havel. For as he's already said in chapter 1, verse 15, who can straighten what God has made bent? And so rather, what he's saying is that the duty of man is bound up with eating, drinking, and labor, for that is his lot in God's will for man. Are you tracking? And so the conclusion of Solomon here is one I think we can rest in. The message here is that though oftentimes hard and indeed unjust, life is still a gift. It's something still to be enjoyed. And so true, lasting, unwavering contentment comes not only by resting in the surety of future judgment, but also by simply enjoying the gifts of God in the details of life. And so he says in this final phrase, look, you don't know what's to come after you. In other words, stop looking ahead and trying to control what's to come under the sun. But instead, as you wait for that final day, learn to rest in the gifts of today, for that is God's will and desire for his people. And that's the counsel of Solomon. So what are we to do with this? Well, let me just really quickly say that verses 1 through 3 of chapter 4 really do belong to this section because they deal with the same kind of issues we've just seen. And really the only difference is that instead of injustice, he deals with the issue of oppression, which if you think about it is really just another form of injustice. And so I don't think we really need to walk through those verses. I think the meaning's pretty clear. I will say, though, that verse 3 is a little troublesome for some people because he talks there about it being better for the oppressed to just never have been born. And so all he's doing there is really just making the observation that oppression is a reality of life. And then he just gives a sort of emotional response. It's a very human response from a man living under the sun. And so it isn't the kind of statement where you should try to draw out any sort of theology. And so I think what I'll do here is just sort of try and draw your attention to the structure. So notice, he's dealt with the issue of injustice in the beginning of our passage and then ends with his observation of oppression at the end. And so what he's done here is actually sandwich his conclusion of the two issues in the middle of the two observations. And so while the structure is a bit strange and kind of clumsy, let me try and bring this all together. What can we learn from Solomon this morning? Well, I have four sort of implications from this passage. So number one, if you want to be a wise person who's able to navigate well the hardships of life, and particularly the injustices of life, whether they be big, small, global, national, or right in your own home, it must begin by acknowledging the fact that not only does injustice exist, which I don't think anybody in this room would deny, but by accepting the fact that in this Havel-ridden world, the reality of injustice and oppression will always exist. And I'm not saying here that we should just ignore injustice and not desire righteousness, but I am saying that the wisdom of Solomon dictates that we must accept the fact that there's a great sense in which wickedness will always be a reality. And that this is just one of those issues under the sun for which there is no ultimate solution. For as Solomon has said over and over again, this world is permanently bent. Havel. Second, we must remember Jesus, the greater Solomon, who humbled himself by coming under the sun to suffer the greatest form of injustice and oppression this world has ever known. For those who perhaps in this room have suffered a kind of injustice that very few could understand, the message for you this morning is remember Christ. Take comfort in the one who knows in the greatest measure what it means to be unjustly treated. The King of this universe, in whom, as Colossians 1 says, holds the world together by the very word of his power, who gives and grants to all life, breath, and all things, who deserved nothing but honor, praise, and adulation, humbled himself, taking the form of a man to be mocked, beaten, spit upon, and ultimately crucified. He knows what it means to be in a place where the one who has done no wrong is severely mistreated, while all around the wicked seem to prevail and even prosper. He's a sympathetic high priest who hears your prayers, knows your pain, and longs for the injustice to be made right. So remember Christ. He is not absent. He sees all things, whether they be hidden or known, and promises to bring everything to account. Third, remember Jesus as forgiver. Remember him not only as the one who comforts, but as the one who's more acquainted and one who's more acquainted with the havel of injustice and oppression than anybody in the history of the world. But remember that he was unjustly treated to solve the problem not only of the world's injustices, but in the first instance, the problem of your injustice. All sin, past, present, and future, is always an injustice against the one who day after day continues to give you undeserved life, breath, and all things. And so while it's so easy to see the injustice in the courts and condemn all the acts of oppression which are being done under the sun, we must never lose sight of the fact that injustice and oppression flow from our own hearts in the subtlest of ways. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus is speaking, and the context is regarding an evil generation, and he tells the Pharisees there, who would have been very familiar with Ecclesiastes in no uncertain terms, that something greater than Solomon is here, which of course Jesus was referring to himself. And so one of the things that made Jesus so much greater than Solomon is he had this ability to rebuke those who were constantly looking at the evils of others and instead realign their thoughts so as to expose the evil of their own hearts by focusing them on the corruption of their own wickedness. Something to which we're all so often blind. And so it was in the midst of one of the most corrupt generations that Jesus was so dead set on getting people to stop looking at everybody else and instead force them to take a look at their own souls. Injustice, oppression, and wickedness are always the result of sinful people, and there's not one person in this room that's exempt. All of us have flowing from our innermost being sin. And so one of the things that makes Jesus greater than Solomon is that while Solomon is able to give us wisdom to navigate through a world riddled with havel, Solomon admits over and over again that he has no ultimate solution. And so while we're still living in a world defined by havel that we still have to navigate, the function of this passage for the Christian, or even for those who might not yet trust Christ, is to look to Christ, who by suffering the greatest of injustices suffered to pay the penalty of your injustice and offer total, lasting forgiveness, so that when judgment comes, you might say with total confidence and surety of mind that you are absolutely guilty, but 100% forgiven. All of your injustice, all of your oppression, all of your wickedness and sin, past, present, and future, will have no bearing in the judgment. If you trust Christ, The only pronouncement over your soul will be from the mouth of Christ himself is, well done, my good, faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your master. And that's good news. Last, my final word to us this morning is to conclude with Solomon. That though we live and will always live in a world of injustice and oppression, the call on your life and mine is to find contentment in the good gifts and the details of life. Because while wickedness might seem to rule the day, the hope of the Christian is grounded in the judgment of Christ, where not only is there complete forgiveness, but also on that day we'll come to know a reality in which all that is wrong, all that is bent and broken and upside down will finally and forever be made straight. And that's a true hope. It's a kind of hope that if you, by faith, come to know and believe, is the kind of hope that in the midst of a world defined by Havel will allow you to know a true joy, a true peace, and a kind of rest that is forever and full. And so my hope and my prayer for us this morning is that we would learn to trust and love this truth.